So I am indeed delighted to be back in Thailand. I have returned here a few times since I left in 1979, but it's always lovely to be here. Even though I was born in England physically, my life as a monk began here in Thailand, and particularly up in the northeast in Ubon province. So I feel that my life as a monk, my spiritual life, began here in Thailand. So the theme for this evening, What is the Buddha's Enlightenment? When this title was suggested to me, I felt that I would necessarily be a bit cheeky to be so audacious to be talking on a subject like that, which is one of the indescribable things. But I've always been ready to jump in and say my piece, and to risk overestimating my understanding. So please forgive me if that is overestimating, or that the cheek of talking about the Buddha's enlightenment when one is not a fully enlightened being oneself. You think, well, how does he have the nerve? Who does he think he is? Or maybe if he's talking on this subject, he's trying to tell us that he is an arahant, or even a Buddha. So I hope that you do not think that, and that what I would like to do this evening is to offer some reflections from my own perspective upon this theme, what the theme says to me, how that appears as an important quality, and in a sense the very center of the life of someone who is living in a way, endeavoring to follow the Buddha's teaching, living in a way to free the heart from all confusion, to free the heart from any kind of peace, any kind of obstruction to peacefulness, any kind of limitation. When I was considering this theme, when it was suggested to me by the good people, Mobhan Cha and the others here of BIA, what immediately sprang to mind was way back in the early 1980s, when the Chitta Viveka Monastery had just opened in southern England. Lumpur Sumato was very active in his role as a teacher. He was the abbot, he was the head of the community, he was the senior monk, and very abundant in his offering of Dhamma teachings. So every day in the morning, he would offer some reflections. Every evening there would be a formal Dhamma talk after the evening chanting. So it was a great fountain, a flood of Dhamma teachings during those years. And as that was my formative time as a monk, I was a young bhikkhu of maybe two or three, four reigns, four pansa. It was a very, very important time for me. And just as many teachers have the habit of, they take a single phrase or a single theme and they repeat it, they use it to offer teachings and reflections for a period of years. Like Venerable Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, for a long time he spoke exclusively on the theme of Iddhapachayata, or the law of causality in Buddhist philosophy. Or for a long time he would talk about the importance of understanding rather than superstition. And so he used the Thai phrase "Benyang Ni Eng." This is the way it is. And Ajahn Buddhadasa, as most people who are regulars of Suan Mok or Suan Mok Krung Thep will know, that he was very much against all kinds of superstition and didn't like amulets and the kind of that side of the Buddhist customs. But he said there is one amulet that might do you some good. And but that amulet will have one thing inscribed upon it, And what the words are written upon it are Benyang Ni Eng. So that whenever you look at your amulet, you remember that, then it tells you, it reminds you, this is the way it is. So he said, that kind of an amulet, that kind of a protection is really useful. That it reminds you of that. So for some years he would speak on Benyang Ni Eng. Ajahn Chah, my own teacher, would have similar themes. He would ask people, if you can't go forwards and you can't go backwards and you can't stand still, where do you go? And then put that as a question to people and go, oh, my sap, Lumpa. To the side, up, down, mate. So in a similar way, Lumpa Sumato, in those early years, one of those themes that he used a lot, over and over again, he would say with great emphasis, what is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? What is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? And the implication of the way he would say it in this kind of dramatic fashion, that you're supposed to be expecting, ooh, he's going to tell us about some kind of amazing cosmic magical truth about the nature of the cosmos and all of the realms of different beings, or all the different layers upon layers of past lives and future lives, and something really magical and amazing and fantastic. And so he would make that statement, ask that question, what is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? He would pause for a moment, and then he'd say, what Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know is that all that arises passes away and is not self. Think, oh, well, that's pretty ordinary. And that was the point, is because rather than something fantastic or strange or magical or mysterious, what he is pointing to over and over again is the really important thing that the Buddha knows, that what the truly awakened and wise mind is aware of is that everything that arises passes away and is not self. And though even that might sound very unfantastic or unremarkable, it's like in the Thai language, those obviously many people here are Thai speakers and many of us are not. My Thai is extremely rudimentary. I was teaching at a school earlier today, Rongrien Siam Samtrai, and I think I got about 2 out of 10 for my Thai speaking. But the important thing to understand is that within the ordinary, there is the extraordinary. So in the word, the Thai word for ordinary, tamada, tamada, it's ordinary, normal, not special, no big thing, right? Tamada, ben tamada. But if you look at the way the word is written, if you look at the letters of the Thai word tamada, you can see that it comes from the Pali word dhammata, dhammata, of the nature of Dhamma. So this shouldn't be a secret. because what it's telling you is that hidden inside the ordinary is the very extraordinary, or is the most important thing. Now the attention, when we think about the theme, what is the Buddha's enlightenment? Maybe when you saw that on the poster, you thought, whoa, we'll get some kind of really special revelation, some kind of fantastic description about the nature of the cosmos and past lives, or a kind of hyper intricate explanation of the enlightenment process as described in the Abhidhamma. But I felt what's more useful is to look at this kind of a theme. Yeah, that how simple, how ordinary, how close it is, and how easily we miss it. That the nature of the Buddha's enlightenment is to really know, right down to our bones, to the marrow of our bones, that all that arises passes away and is not self. And when we understand what that means, when the true implications of a simple phrase like that sinks in, then why that is so important is because when that the truth of that sinks in, at least from my perspective, my experience, then our perception of the world, our experience of the world, our experience of ourself changes radically and in a way, brings us to a different world that we are living in. Now, it was not just Lumpur Sumedho who's talking in this kind of a way, but if you go all the way back in time, rewind 2,500 years or more, back to the time of the Buddha, then there is an occasion that is described in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses. For those of you who are Sutta scholars, it's Sutta number 123, and its title is The Wonderful and Marvelous. And it starts off with Venerable Ananda and a group of monks gathered together and in one of the halls in the monastery. And they, because Ananda has a perfect recall, has extraordinary powers of memory. And so they are asking Ananda to recount, you know, what was the nature of the birth of the Buddha? What was what were all the things that occurred during that time? And the Venerable Ananda is expounding on this theme at great length, and he says, "Oh, well, when before the Bodhisattva was born, then he was living in as a Bodhisattva up in the." The Tusita heaven, and that that was a wonderful and marvelous thing. It was an incredible thing. Many thousands of years he spent in that blissful realm, knowing that his next birth would be his last birth in the world. This was a wonderful and marvelous thing. And then when he was, going to be conceived by his mother and father, his mother had a dream of a white elephant with six tusks entering her side, and this was a wonderful, a marvelous, amazing thing. And when the Bodhisattva had been conceived in the womb of his mother, then her body became completely comfortable and fully at ease. She was without illnesses or pain or difficulty. This is a wonderful, a marvelous, incredible thing. During the whole time of her pregnancy, then her mind was only disposed towards wholesome things. She never had any kind of unwholesome thoughts, and she became naturally virtuous, and her heart was unsullied and full of purity and brightness. And this is another wonderful and marvelous thing. And then during the time, he goes many of these different things experienced by the Buddha's mother, Queen Mahamaya, and then describing the time of the birth. He said, the Bodhisattva's mother, she didn't give birth lying down or sitting down, but she gave birth standing up. And she didn't give birth in a building, but rather in the forest in Lumbini. And she gave birth standing up. And then as the Bodhisattva appeared from his mother, then he was unsullied by any kind of birth fluids or humors or a kind of anything that was ugly or untidy or coarse, but was, as he appeared, then immediately warm jets and cool jets of water appeared from the sky and washed both him and his mother. And also devatas appeared and caught the Bodhisattva as he appeared from his mother and was born. So, and this was all, you know, wonderful, amazing, marvelous things. And he goes on and on in this kind of a vein, saying how at that time then there was the beautiful music from the Gandharvas appeared in the sky, and there were earthquakes that shook the whole world, and this incredible bright blazing light shone throughout all of the 10,000 universal systems, all the different realms of being. And even down in the darkest depths of the lower realms, a light shone, and beings who had never seen light before, suddenly their realms were filled with light. And this was another wonderful and marvelous, amazing thing. So I won't bore you with more details. Ananda continues in this vein, one after another after another, these extraordinary, miraculous, and strange events around the birth of the Bodhisattva, until finally he, even as a baby, sat down on the ground, stands up and starts walking, and takes seven steps, and under each footstep a lotus appears. And after taking seven steps, this is a newborn baby, he raises his hand in the air and says, "I am the leader in the world. I am the foremost in the world." So not only walking, but talking immediately after his birth. Pretty amazing. Yeah. So that any of you who saw that film, Little Buddha, and saw that account, that Bertolucci wasn't straying too far from what you find in the scriptures. So as it happens during these stories, the Lord Buddha showed up right at that moment and said, so what are you all talking about? What are you gathered together for here in this hall? What was the conversation that I interrupted when I arrived? And Ananda said, "Oh, Venerable Sir, I was describing many of the wonderful and marvelous things that happened around the time of the Blessed One's birth." And as they do in the Pali Suttas, he recounts everything that he'd already said, verbatim. And saying how this is a wonderful and marvelous thing, a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. So as he gets to the end of his long recounting, a long recitation, then the Buddha says, "Do you want to hear another wonderful and marvelous thing about the Tathagata?" And you can almost feel the monks sort of leaning forward. Oh, whoa, we thought that was amazing, wonderful enough. Now he's really going to wow us with some kind of special revelation. And he says, "When a feeling arises in the mind of the Tathagata, he knows the arising of that feeling, he knows it in its presence, and he knows its fading away. This is a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. When a thought arises in the mind of the Tathagata, he knows this thought has arisen, he knows its presence, he knows its fading away. This too is a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. When any perception or sensation, any mental formation whatsoever, arises within the mind of the Tathagata, he knows it in its arising, he knows it in its abiding, he knows it in its fading away. This too is a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha." "Venerable Sir, yes, we will indeed remember this as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One." So right there, in that encounter, while all of the disciples are getting kind of drunk on all the amazing and miraculous things, what the Buddha points to, he says, "Well, that's all very well, but what's really amazing, what's really extraordinary, is that the mind can be fully aware of a sensation, a perception, a mood, liking, disliking, pleasure, pain, happiness, unhappiness, the visible forms, sounds, any pattern of consciousness whatsoever. It can be known, it can be seen, it can be understood without any confusion." And this is what he points to as being wonderful and marvelous. So what he's directing our attention towards is what is wonderful and marvelous is that how when we consider, when we see things in this way, our own life can be changed. Because that clear seeing, that clear knowing, this is the primal liberating quality of our own heart, our own mind. That capacity to be awake, to be aware, to know, the quality of vidya, or of awareness, knowing, the quality of true panya, lokuttara panya, supramundane wisdom. All these words apply to that same quality of clear knowing. Now, Lumpo Cha, along with a number of the other forest ajans, when they talk about the Buddha or taking refuge in the Buddha, Lumpo Cha used this expression saying, there are really two Buddha, there are two Buddhas. There is the Buddha in body and the Buddha in mind. There are two kinds of Buddha. And this is, I understand, is somewhat revolutionary thinking or unusual kind of thinking. But he would use this form of expression saying there are really two kinds of Buddha, the Buddha in body and the Buddha in mind. So the Buddha in body is like, say, Gautama Buddha, our teacher, the great sage who was fully enlightened 2,600 years ago and whose brilliant and liberating teachings are still alive in the world today. So this is the Buddha in the physical realm, or the Buddha in body. But then Buddha in mind, by using that expression, what Ajahn Chah would point to is say, this is the Puru in the Thai language, the one who knows, that quality of awareness in our mind. This is the Buddha in mind. And so that when we take refuge in the Buddha, he would say, again, quite revolutionary or radical thinking, and as a very conservative monk, you know, it's unusual to talk in this way, but he would say, when you take refuge in Buddha, we're not in the main taking refuge in the memory of the great sage who lived in India 2,500, 2,600 years ago. Because the memory or the idea of a great being who lived far away thousands of years ago, that is unable to be a true refuge for our citta, for our heart, here and now. It can be an inspiring idea, a very noble, say, set of qualities that are embodied or described. But what is a true refuge? He said, a true refuge is a safe place. Like here we have the Buddhadasa Indapanyo archive here in Bangkok, and just talking with friends early on, Khun Noi, saying, oh, this is such a precious place to have right in the middle of Bangkok. You have the Nibbana room. You have a Nibbana with a small N. It's a cool room. Here in the center of Bangkok, right by Chatuchak Market, we have this is a refuge from a busy city, noisy, filled with activity. So this place is a physical refuge. So the Buddha in mind, that quality of awareness, Lumpo Cha and Lumpo Sumedho and many of the other forest ajahns would say, this is the refuge that can really be of benefit to us. This is the truly safe place. Because when you are able to, say, take refuge in that Buddha, be aware, to truly be awake, then there is a sense of profound security, stability. It's also interesting in the Thai language to use the word puru. It means the one who knows. It refers both to the Buddha in body and the Buddha in mind. So when you would say, like in the chanting, Puru, Pudan, Pubagban, it's referring to the Buddha as the great being and our teacher, our spiritual master who lived all those years ago. But it's also referring to Puru, is that internal quality of awareness right now. And not thinking like, oh, yeah, I wonder if I've got some. Or I was probably born without any. Yeah. And that's only something that the special people have got. You know. But if you are here now, if you're conscious of my words, even if you don't understand them, then the puru is active. That is that very quality of knowing, the quality of awareness. And the more that awareness is freed from confusion, it's freed from, say, attachment to like and dislike, attachment to sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, the more that awareness is unentangled with thoughts and feelings, perceptions, moods, the inner world and the outer world, the more that awareness is clear and open and uncluttered, unentangled, then the more fully the heart experiences that sense of security, of stability, and of peacefulness, of brightness. Again, in Thai language, they have a very beautifully alliterative set of words to describe this. Sawan, sa'ad, sangop. And my Thai accent is very poor, so I'm sure I'm getting the tones all wrong. Sawan is bright, radiant. Sa'ad is pure. Sangop is peaceful. So pure, radiant, and peaceful. So the more that quality of awareness is unconfused, then the more that quality of peacefulness and freedom and clarity is embodied, is realized. So when we talk about awareness, this quality of knowing, we can consider that this is the essence of vipassana, or insight meditation. That the process of developing insight meditation is to learn how to establish that quality of knowing in a clear and unconfused way, so that the heart is able to witness the arising and passing, just like in the sutta on the wonderful and marvelous, or just like Lumpur Sumedho's encouragement to us back in the early 80s, to be the one who knows the arising and passing away of feelings, of thoughts, of perceptions, to be that very knowing, to be that awareness. Now, this is what is the aim of insight meditation. Because through the training in, samatha, focusing the mind on the present moment, and in the process of vipassana, developing insight, we learn to be able to be that very aware and open quality, to be that, to know that, and to allow the perceptions and thoughts and feelings. Just as all the people, we've all arrived in this space, people come and go, they're coming and going all the time. There is the people in this room, there's the space in this room. The space receives everything without discrimination. People come in, they sit down, they get up, they walk out. The space in the room does not argue with the people, right? The space is just here. It receives everything without bias, without partiality, without preference. Other people might have biases. You say, oh, I don't want to sit next to him. I've been arguing with her. I want to be, I don't want her. She shouldn't be allowed in. I don't like her. So the people might be biased, but the space is not. The space receives everything without discrimination. It's a non-discriminating awareness, a pure and open, unbiased awareness. So our minds are exactly the same. And in this moment, as we can see, we have our eyes open and we can see the room, or we have our eyes closed. We see the back of our eyelids, but we hear the sound. But the sound of my voice, the images of this room, the Buddha Rupa, the me sitting here, the other monks, the other people gathered together, the shape of the room, the feeling of the temperature, these are all sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, arising and passing away. If I have my eyes open, I see all kinds of color. I close my eyes, I see the back of my eyelids. See, dum-dum. I open my eyes, then the world of color reappears. So what I see is happening in my mind. What you see, what you hear, is happening in your mind. So what this means is that we don't experience the world, we experience our mind's representation of the world, the image that our mind conjures up that represents the world. But it all happens here. It happens in our own citta. It's not, we think, oh, the world is out there, that's Bangkok out there, or that's the group of people gathered together to listen to the Dhamma at BIA. They're out there, I'm in here. But actually, it's all in here. The world is in our mind. Does that make sense? It's not to say that there isn't a real Bangkok that's out there, or that people don't really exist. There are, yes, there is a basis for all of our experience, our perceptions. But our experience of the world all happens here. It is known within this mind. And when we are able to see, oh, this is feeling, perception, thoughts, moods, memories, ideas, plans, arising and passing away. These are just patterns of nature coming into being, doing their thing, and dissolving. Just as the Buddha said, the Tathagata, the one who knows, sees the arising of a perception, sees it in its abiding, and sees it fading away. when we abide in that position of the Buddha, simply knowing and receiving the flow of impressions, then without, say, partiality. So when something is experienced that is delightful, beautiful, then we don't try and grab it. We recognize that it has a beautiful quality or a pleasant taste, a beautiful smell, like the lovely garlands of fragrant flowers. Bowing to the shrine, I was almost distracted by the hong, the beautiful scent of all the flowers. But that beautiful smell, we can smell it, but we can also not try to grab it or keep it. Something that is unpleasant, we can know this is painful, this is unpleasant. We don't have to reject it, push it away. We can know, oh, this is a painful feeling. This is a pleasant feeling. This is a beautiful object, an ugly object. Or this is a neutral object. That when they are simply known and received, then we are able to, say, live in peace and able to work with the world, to relate to the world with a heart that is unconfused, so that when we are experiencing something painful or difficult, we don't run away or we don't fight against it. We are able to know this is painful, this is a bitter taste, this is discomfort. But we also recognize fundamentally this is just an impression, a mental impression. This is something that the mind is experiencing. That's all, no more, no less. And the heart that knows that is able to receive that, participate in that experience without confusion, without being entangled, then we are truly in tune with the world and at peace with the world, so that we're not grasping hold, we're not pushing away, but we're learning how to be in tune with the world, so that we're able to respond in life, respond to our family, to the people we work with, respond to the planet that we live upon and the country that we are a part of. We're able to respond to the needs and to be able to offer what we can to help and to be of assistance to other beings. What we do, what we can do, then we do with a good heart. What we can't do, then we create no problems in ourselves about. So when we consider the Buddha's enlightenment, it might seem like some kind of very grand, special, distant event, like, oh, that happened 2,600 years ago. Ooh, that's a long time back. But if you have been hearing what I've been saying, then, and if we think about the Buddha in mind, that you might say, well, I'm not a Buddha, I'm just a guy who lives in Bangkok, I'm just an expat, or I'm a woman, how could I be a Buddha? You know, that's barb to even think that way. You know, this monk is totally shameless or got wrong view. But I can hide behind the fact that I'm merely quoting my teacher, Lumpo Cha. So he didn't say it's only for monks who have Buddha in mind as well as Buddha in body. He didn't say it's only arahants. He didn't say it's only men. But he pointed to this is a quality of every mind. Every single one of our minds has this quality. We couldn't be here if we did not possess that quality of awareness. So that's how one should understand it. So when we are considering the Buddha's enlightenment, what we are I'm asking or suggesting to consider is that this is how to be awake here and now. That the Buddha's enlightenment, that was a very grand and unique, amazing event. It took place in Bodh Gaya 2,600 years ago. We now and here can have at least a small, comparable experience when we wake up to the feeling of, say, discomfort in our knees. Maybe some of you not used to sitting on the floor for a long time. We can wake up to the discomfort in our knee, or we can wake up to the frustration of not being able to understand the English. Or we can wake up to the delight in being able to understand a Dhamma talk in your own language for a change. to consider the enlightenment of the Buddha in this way is to consider, oh, this very puru, this very quality of awareness, applying that here and now, I can say, oh, this is the sweet feeling of being able to understand a Dhamma talk in my own language. Or this is the bitter feeling of knowing, this is, I'm sure this is a great Dhamma talk, and I can't understand a word. That's to know, that's a bitter feeling. This is the feeling of frustration. That's all. No more, no less. But if you can't understand English at all, then you won't even understand me explaining this. So, but anyway, the awakening of the Puru, applying the quality of the Puru, the one who knows, being awake, being aware here and now, this is, I would suggest, this is truly the path of liberation. This is how the heart is freed. And the Buddha taught, in order to help the hearts of living beings to be freed. That's why he spent 45 years after that enlightenment experience traveling barefoot through Bihar and Uttar Pradesh and northern India, traveling and teaching and endlessly ready to offer his insight, to explain and to guide and to encourage people to practice according to this understanding so that our hearts could be freed. Now, quite a number of years ago, Lumpur Panyananta, who was a good friend, Sahadamika of Lumpur Buddha Thart, Lumpur Panyananta and Lumpur Buddha Thasa, they were good friends, Dhamma companions from way, way back into the, I think, 1930s and 1940s. And they collaborated together to found the original Suan Mok down in Chayar. During the time that our teacher, Ajahn Chah, became ill, he had a stroke and was paralyzed, could not speak. Then Lumpur Panyananta very kindly, generously, took the initiative to be a mentor, to step up and to help the community of the Pratfarang, the disciples of Ajahn Chah, who lived in the West, because he could see, well, these people have lost their dad. Mami Por. And so he thought, he realized, oh, I can do that, because he was familiar with teaching in the West. He also had a great admiration for Ajahn Chah's teachings. And so that he came and visited many of our monasteries in Britain and in other countries. And one year he came at the Visakha Puja time to Amaravati Monastery, where I live now. And he gave a very memorable Dhamma talk at that time on one Vesak, because I don't know if everybody here is aware, but the festival of Visakha Puja, the full moon day, usually in May, this year it was in June, but that full moon day is the day on which the Buddha was born, the day on which he was enlightened 35 years later, and the day that he passed away, day of the Parinibbana, 45 years after that. So all three of those events are understood to have occurred on the full moon day of May, the Visakha Puja. So that they're all three, the birth of the Bodhisatta and the enlightenment and then the final passing away of the Buddha, all occurred on the full moon day of May on those three different years. Lumpur Panyananta gave this very interesting Dhamma talk on this kind of theme. He said, you know, we think of these events happening all those hundreds and hundreds of years ago, 25 centuries ago, and we might think that that's inspiring and very beautiful, but long ago and far away, and so of no real relevance here and now. But he said, but you should consider, why is it that those three are brought together? What do they have in common? And also, Lumpur Panyananda, he was very close in his, understanding about superstition to the way of seeing that Ajahn Buddhadasa had, that he was not very fond of superstition and those kind of the customs and beliefs that go along with Buddhist tradition. And so he said, you know, according to the history, maybe those events really did occur on the full moon day of May. Maybe they did not, which again is kind of a heretical way to speak, but also Acharya Buddhadasa was not afraid of sounding like a heretic sometimes. This is what Lumpo Panyananta said, if I remember correctly. He said, you know, maybe they occurred on the full moon day of May, maybe not. But we do know, we have the tradition that they are all events that occurred on the full moon day of May. So we should consider, why is it? What do they have in common? What does their coming together say to us? How does that give us a practical teaching? And what he said was, when we think about the life of the Buddha, we can actually think of that as the experience of a single moment. Say, if you bring it right down to the experience, not just of today, not just of this hour, but of this very present moment, we can see the story of the life of the Buddha, the birth of the Bodhisattva, all the way to the Parinibbana. We can see that occurring right here and now, in a single experience. And so what he said was, you can compare why these three things are brought together is because they're pointing to, they're all part of a single process. So he said, when a thought arises in the mind of an ordinary person, the thought arises, then it's like the birth of the Bodhisattva. So when the Buddha was born, he was a child of great potential. He had this miraculous events around his birth, but when he was growing up, he lived the life of a boy in a princely family in Kapilavatu, but yet he was trained to be a soldier. He was he carried weapons. He learned the ways of the army. He was learning the ways of rulership. He didn't understand his life for the first 29 years. He was married at the age of 16 to Princess Yashodhara. He had the child Rahula, and so during that time, from the birth up to the enlightenment, he was living as an ordinary person. But along the way, he began to experience the truth of aging, sickness, and death. We have the story of the experience of the Bodhisattva seeing the four signs and traveling outside of Kapilavatu, outside the palace of Kapilavatu, and seeing an old person, a sick person, a dead body, and then finally a wandering samana, a rishi, a monk, on the streets of Kapilavatu. So Lompo Panya explained, say, this is like when a thought arises. First of all, we don't realize it's a thought. We're caught up in the feeling of it. We have an impression arises, like we like something. Oh, I like that. We have no idea that it's a feeling of liking. It's just born and it just does its thing. And so then, after a while of that feeling of liking something, after a while, we begin to notice that. And there's a recognition of, well, I like this and I want this, but I haven't got it. There's a feeling of dukkha, of frustration, dissatisfaction that arises, that is something that becomes known to us. Like, I want that and I can't get it. Anybody here had that feeling before? It's a trick question, right? I don't think any of us would be here if we hadn't had that feeling. Chime in? So this is when we recognize, oh, I want that, but I can't have it. This is painful. The life of the Buddha then is at that moment is when he experiences the four signs. And then earlier today, I was saying to one of the visitors here, the Buddha explained that suffering or dukkha, says it ripens in two ways. So the first way is that dukkha ripens in more dukkha, that suffering leads to more suffering. I think we're all familiar with that one too. So that because we don't get what we want, then we steal it off somebody else, or we borrow some money to get it, or we just go without it and feel frustrated, and then the suffering continues. The second way that suffering ripens, he says, it ripens in search, which is to say that there's this recognition of, there must be a possibility of being without this painful experience. There must be something other than this feeling of suffering. So what is the way, what is the path to get out of this feeling, to get beyond this feeling, to transcend dukkha? Now, there must be something. Now, where is it? What is it? How do I find it? So this is what is meant by search. So that is what occurred after the Buddha saw the four signs and was inspired by the sight of the Samana, the wandering monk. So then, as we all know, then he took after Rahula was born, he took leave in the middle of the night and left the home life and became a yogi, an ascetic. And so this Lungpo Panya said, so that when you have recognized dukkha, you're suffering, you want to do something about it, but you don't know quite how to handle it. So you're trying to work with this feeling of dissatisfaction, but you're not sure how to do it and what to do. And so you're trying to get rid of that feeling of frustration by just forcing it out of your mind, or trying to just fix your attention on something else. You're wrestling with it, you're fighting against it, but you haven't found a way to deal with it effectively. No matter how much you try to suppress the feeling of desire, it keeps coming back, it keeps returning. Just like you keep putting the dog outside, and as soon as you put the dog out, it wants to come back in again. It's a very common experience in Britain, in the West. The dog scratches on the door, wants to get out, and as soon as it's outside, it scratches on the door, wants to come back in. So the mind never comes to an end of its restlessness. Now then, so this feeling of wanting has arisen in our mind, and then at a certain point, we recognize, well, just trying to force it to go away, trying to just to force that desire to stop, to make it shut up, just to putting it outside, it just keeps coming back in again. So dealing with it just by force, by trying to suppress it, get rid of it, wipe it out, to annihilate it, that doesn't work. So this is when the Buddha realized this life as an ascetic, eating one grain of rice a day, so skinny that if I touch my stomach, I can feel my backbone. He realized, this is not the way. Now, there must be another way. Now what is it? So this is the discovery of the middle way. And so that then that insight, that intuition that the Bodhisattva had, that there must be another way, there must be a more balanced way. Now, what is it? And he was drawn towards a feeling of the Majjhima Patipada, the middle way. So the stories also say that it was because of hearing somebody playing a veena, a musical instrument, that he had this idea, and he realized, hey, when I lived in the palace and I had a luxurious life with my beautiful wife and all of the dancing girls and the kind of luxury of the palace life, and the life in the army, and fighting with the lads, and enjoying the sensuality of the world. That was a time when my strings were too slack. Now I take up the life of the ascetic, I was trying to find happiness through indulgence in pleasure. That didn't work. My strings were too slack. Then I tried to find happiness by wiping out all feeling, by suppressing all feeling. And my strings are too tight. So what I need to do is to find a way of tuning my life to have everything more in harmony. And the word samma, as in samma ditti, samma sankappo, samma vacha, of the Eightfold Path, the factors of the Eightfold Path, each one has the word samma before it. And that word samma is a musical term. And it means in tune. So rather than samma ditti meaning right view as in opposed to wrong view, it means more attuned view, or view which is harmonious with reality. Views which are in tune with reality. The intentions that are in tune with reality. Speech that is in tune with reality. Samā ditti, samā sankappo, samā vācā, samā kammanto, and so on. So when what this means is when we have this feeling of desire, of wanting something arising, then we follow along with it, then we try to fight against it, we realize none of those work, and we think, oh, we recognize, oh, I was swept up by that feeling, now I'm just trying to wipe it out. Neither of those are working, aha! Then we remember the Buddha's teaching, and we let go of that tension, but we're holding in a skillful and balanced way, so, and we bring that quality of awareness to that experience. And when we recognize, oh, this is the feeling of wanting, that's all. This is the feeling of wanting. Then we are able to know that. And in that moment, you can say that is the moment of the Buddha's enlightenment, the dratsaru, at that moment, the puru, of the quality of awareness, the wisdom of our own heart, knows, ah, this is just a feeling. It's a feeling of wanting, and it might be very, very powerful, like, I gotta have. It might be very powerful and very convincing, but it can only be just a feeling. It can't be more than that, can it? It is just a feeling. It might be a very convincing feeling, like a movie that is a really good movie, so you're completely absorbed in it, but it is just a movie, right? So when if we look upon the awakening of the puru, the bringing to life, the embodiment of the puru, the one who knows, that unentangled participation in that experience, then everything changes. When that heart, the moment the heart recognizes, right, it is just a feeling, then even though the feeling is still there, then we live with that, but our relationship to that feeling of wanting is irreversibly changed. So this, then Lumpo Panyananda said, this is like the life of the Buddha, then carries on, that yes, there's the taking shape of the Sangha, the teaching for 45 years. You can say that's all the continuing experience of that feeling, but without any confusion about it. That feeling of liking or of appreciating, that's still there, that's still a fragrant smell or a beautiful taste or an attractive shape or object or form in a painting or a person. But you can say, well, that's just a beautiful object. I don't have to chase after it, I don't have to want it, I don't have to get rid of it, I don't have to be afraid of it. My life is not incomplete if I do not draw close to that, or if it doesn't come into my possession. So what we're seeing is that there's a difference between, in this instance, there's a difference between liking and wanting. As long as the heart is unawakened, as long as there is confusion and attachment, then there's an entanglement in that wanting. I gotta have. We feel incomplete, and we believe that the thing that we want will make us complete. It will fill that, it will provide that missing piece, the bit that we seem to be missing, that we haven't got. And it promises, yes, yes, I am the thing that you are missing. So if you just get this new upgrade on your computer, the new car, the promotion, the new house, etc. Go to the new monastery, visit the new ajahn, in town. You know. That's going to make all the difference, right? This is going to be the thing that really changes it. But Jing de mai tu, tuk de mai jing. It's true, but it's not right. It does change things, but not for very long, and not completely. So then Lumpo Panya said, this is when we follow a feeling, we know the feeling happening, we're aware of it, it does its thing, just like the life of the Buddha. The many thousands of events and extraordinary and beautiful things took shape over the Buddha's lifetime. And then finally, in Kusinara, the Buddha's life came to an end. The life as in the human realm came to a close. So he said, this is just like that condition coming to a finish, that feeling of liking or appreciating, or the presence of that object disappears, it comes to an end, and then There's no more support for that feeling. There's nothing fueling it. So then there's no more to be said about it. You don't have to have any feeling of relationship to it. It's gone. It's finished. That feeling has faded away. So just like when you wake up in a dream, you were having a dream while you were asleep. When you woke up, it's gone. If you say, well, where did the dream go? Where's it gone? Mein Ei. It's like, say, people say, well, where does an enlightened being go after they die? When the body dies, what happens to an enlightened being? It's like asking, yeah, what happened? Where did all the people I was dreaming of go to? They were really convincing. When I was dreaming, they seemed real. Where did they go? So it's like that our thinking does not apply. Our normal human perceptions do not apply. So when a feeling of wanting or liking fades away, then there's no more to be said about it. It's like the Lumpur Panya said, it was like the parinibbana, when bai lao, it's gone. There's nothing more to be said. But we know that when it fades, what remains is peacefulness. And when we do the chanting for someone's passing away, when someone dies, then one of the chants that we do is anicca vata sankara upadavaya dhammino upachittava nirujanti tesang upasamo sukho. All conditioned things are transient. It is of their nature to integrate and then to disintegrate. When they come together, then they fall apart. That's what they do. Having arisen, then they fade away. They pass, they cease to be. And then the last line, te sang wupa somo sukho, means in their passing is peace. So at the passing away of the Tathagata, on that Visakha Puja night, the full moon night of May, all those years ago, 2,555 years ago, you can say that the body passed away, the body disintegrated, the life of the body ceased, but you can't say that the Buddha went anywhere, but you can say that what remained was peacefulness. Tesang upasamo sukho. So when we watch a condition of our mind arise, come into being and fade away, when we pay attention, when something fades, like if you are in this country, when you have the air conditioning on or a fan going, and then you switch the fan off, then the fan shuts off automatically, then for a moment you go, oh, you hadn't noticed that it was making a noise. It works very well with refrigerators. When the fridge switches off, oh, you hadn't realized that there was a noise going on. But then how long does it take before we get distracted by something else? Right? When the fridge switches off, you go, oh, that's nice and quiet. One, two, three. So what else is going on around here? Right? If you count, it's about between 3 and 4 seconds before we start looking for the next thing. Right? So the trick is to not let it stay at 3 or 4 seconds. When the sankhara passes away, when a thought or a feeling or a perception or dhamma talk passes away, then the trick or the skill is to then sustain the attention on the peace that is there when it fades, so that we're not just getting lost in the next distraction or looking for the next interesting thing, but we really allow ourselves to be peacefulness, to be aware of that quality of peace, and to embody, to be that peace itself, to know that peace, and to give ourselves the opportunity to taste that. Because we might think, oh, I'm really longing for peace, if only my life could be peaceful. But we're so addicted to activity that when peace comes, 3 or 4 seconds, it gets boring. So what we're doing with this is learning how to not be bored with peace, to open the heart to that peaceful quality, and to realize it, to know it, to awaken to it. And so then, in this way, the enlightenment of the Buddha is not some glorious and wonderful event that happened 2,500 years ago, that You know, we are the recipients, because of this tradition, this teaching, these practices, we are the recipients of the effects of that in the life of the great sage, Gautama Buddha. But right here and now, in this very moment, that quality of awakening is possible for us. We can know that. We can be awake to this moment. And this is, in a sense, the true. It gives us at least a small taste, a brief taste of that quality of liberation, the enlightenment of the Buddha, when we allow that puru, the awareness of our own heart, to truly know this moment, and then we let go, then that quality of feeling is known without confusion, without complication. The heart is unburdened, and then we stay with that, and the feeling fades, and then we're able to taste the delightfulness of that peace that remains at the end, or as the Buddha called it when he was talking about Dabba the Mullion when he passed away. He said that when it's, in a way, it's the only time the Buddha talks about the experience of parinibbana. He says that the Dabba the Mullion is experiencing unutterable bliss, that it's a supremely blissful. That's the only time in the Pratripitaka that the Buddha talks even a little bit about the parinibbana. But we can see that. We don't just have to believe that in the life of Dabba the Mullion, but we can also know that directly. When we truly let go, we truly allow our heart to taste and know peacefulness, to be peaceful, then there is that unutterable bliss. Even if just for a short time, it's there. And that this then demonstrates, shows to us the actuality and the beauty, the power of the Buddha's enlightenment as an experience known within our own lives. So I have, I've offered enough Dhamma reflections to this first part of the evening. So please, whatever is useful, please take it and use it. Whatever is heretical and wrong and useless, then please leave that aside, and I offer these thoughts for your reflection.
So we will start soon for the Q&A session. Thank you for your attention. At first, you may have some questions that are directly related to the talk. So maybe we should start with those questions. One microphone will be in the audience. You can just raise your hand, and the microphone will go to you.
Dear Ajahn, having realized Nibbana, the Buddha must have felt very light. He must have felt that he now sees that everything is impermanent, that nothing really exists. Therefore, the period between the enlightenment until the Parinibbana must have been a very joyous period for him. And it was possibly not a period of suffering at all for him, having attained that supreme knowledge. So I'm wondering whether, in a way, there is, how would you qualify that period, the post-Nibbana period for the Buddha?
Well, that's the, in essence, that quality of joyfulness is one of the recognized qualities of experience of the Buddha, that he was also known as the joyful one, and that the demeanor that he had was one of complete ease and gracefulness. He was supremely comfortable in the world and in his body and such. So it didn't mean to say that he didn't experience pain. So he still had physical pain. There was times he once trod on a thorn and pierced his foot. When he was an old man, he said, my body is like an old cart that's held together with strings and wires, and the experience of being aged. He said, there's so much discomfort in the body. It's only when I completely absorb my mind into sunyata, into emptiness, in a complete absorption into that, that I can experience any comfort. So he's, while he was in ordinary engagement and in activity with people and not absorbed in that kind of meditation, he was in a physical pain. So he had chronic back pain. And there's numerous incidents where he after giving a Dhamma talk, he's giving a Dhamma talk leaning against the central pillar of the hall, where he says to Sariputta, "Yeah, the assembly is still awake, Sariputta, please carry on giving them some Dhamma. I'm going to go and rest my back." So that the Buddha had a physical body that was totally capable of experiencing pain, but the thing that makes a difference is that he knew how not to make a problem out of it. So it was impossible for him to complain or to feel negative about that. So that, just like I said, you know, you could know the feeling of liking, but not drifting into wanting. You can feel disliking and not allow it to drift into hating. So that in a comparable way, when there's a knowing of an experience, an uncomfortable experience in ourselves, then you can see that, even though that there might be painfulness there, there's also that fundamental sense of all rightness. There's a joyfulness, even with it can be there accompanying any experience. Joyful in a profound sense, not like gleeful, but more like, yeah, this is the way it is. Like when you're getting older, your joints get stiffer, and you try to get up, and everything is there's a kind of groaning that goes on. But also, if you notice in your heart, there's a, yep, that's right, jara, this is old age, here it is, yeah, no mysteries about this, everything is functioning according to plan. But it's Mother Nature's plan rather than my preferences. So yeah, it's important to consider how the Buddha's experience after the enlightenment, he learned how to live in tune with the world. So he wasn't shutting out the experience of the world, but more fully participating in it, but without any confusion. It's interesting that the word that he used to refer to himself, Tathagata, for centuries and centuries, people have been debating, what did he really mean when he made up that word? Because it can have two meanings. It's got two parts to it. The first is Tata, which means thus or such. And then the second word is either agata, which means gone, which means come, or gata, which means gone. So like the A at the beginning makes a negative. So is it tat agata or tata gata? Thus gone or thus come? Is he totally here or totally gone? Utterly imminent, completely here, or utterly gone, completely transcendent? And so the debate has gone on for 25 centuries. What did he really, really, really mean? But the Buddha, if you study the Prasut, and particularly if you learn a bit of Pali, you realize that the Buddha really enjoyed playing on words, double meanings. That he's a very, very, very skilled with the language and is quite playful in many, many places. And my pet theory is that he deliberately used a word with a double meaning, that it means both thus gone and thus come, both completely transcendent of the world, but also completely attuned and participating in the world, Yes, both and. So that then the life of the Buddha is not trying to shut out the world or see, it's all empty, therefore I don't care, it's, none of it exists, doesn't matter, I'm out of here, as they say in America. Like, so long, guys, I'm gone. No, it's also, I'm here, and I'm gone. Does that make sense? Any other questions? All doubts have disappeared? Yeah, one more.
Yeah. You did touch a little bit on the topic that, you know, we should stay with the situation where we are, not pushing any feeling away, just be at peace with it, at, mm-hmm. or stay at ease with it. Right? It seemed realistic with people who live in the city like this to come listen to it and just be at ease with it, because we don't need any more of a new cars or anything of material gain. But I was thinking further, if the people of the Tibetan people who lost the whole country, people that lost their parents to the war or the whole family to the war, or women being raped, living in that past, how could they even start to invite Dhamma or the saying like, this is the way it is, to their life and be at peace with it?
Well, it's just as I was saying to our friend here, and I also said a few times in the talk, when you're at peace with something, it doesn't mean to say that you are inactive, because you can also be at peace with your own initiative. So that... when you are truly at peace with life, you're also recognizing that you are participating in life. You're participating in the world, in the society, in your family. So you belong. You are part of it. It is you. You are it. So, and you can't get away from it. Just like our bodies depend on oxygen, upon food. We are part of it. It is part of us. We are it. So that when talking about being at peace with things, it doesn't mean to say that you are being passive. Kajamai? Being passive means maybe Komarusa, just not doing anything. Someone comes along and hits you. Like you're not peace doesn't mean making yourself numb without feeling or inactive. Because that's why I like to use the word unentangled participation. So rather than just being aware or just watching, I prefer to use that kind of language, because it points to the fact, no, like the Buddha, his response to his enlightenment was to begin teaching, to respond to the needs of the world and to take action, to set up the Sangha, to deliver thousands and thousands of teachings, 84,000 sections of Dhamma. So he took action. But he was also completely at peace while he took action. So that when we talk about being at peace, it doesn't mean to say do nothing, but it means to be in tune with your circumstances, with the situation, the time, the place, the people, and to let your actions be guided by satipanya, by mindfulness and wisdom, by unselfishness, rather than by fear or greed or aversion. So that when we relate to the, let's say, the people who are if our lives have been damaged by war, or we are people who are victims of violence or say mistreatment, it doesn't mean to say to be at peace. Doesn't mean to say do nothing. It means we are learning how to take action, but without contention, without making others into the enemy. So there's a fine line there. But what we usually do is that when we see, say, if we are inclined towards helping other people, that we react to a situation and we find ourselves fighting against the people who are causing harm, or fighting against a group who is causing difficulties, fighting against people in our family who have opinions that are different from our own. So we react to difficult circumstances, even though our intention is to do good or to be peaceful. We can find a continual kind of conflict, talotgan. So what we're trying to do with developing the path of the Buddha, this way of clarity and peacefulness, is learning how to respond rather than react. Because when we react, we see something that we don't like and we push against it. We see something that we like and we take hold of it. So that is what I mean by the English word react or reaction. To respond means there's an environment of satipanya, there's mindfulness and wisdom, so that we see something that we dislike, we see as wrong or harmful, then to respond means to recognize, oh, well, that seems really bad to me. Some action really needs to be taken. Now, what will be a good thing? What's the best way to deal with this? What does my experience tell me? Who is here? Who's involved? What's going to be able to reach that person and help them to change their ways? Yeah. What are my intentions here? Am I coming from a place of unselfishness, or am I coming from a place of righteous indignation? Is there anger here, or is there kindness? So that kind of consideration, pijarana, the kind of exploring, considering, this is what we mean by wise reflection, yoniso manasikara, or mindfulness and wisdom, sati sampajanya, that you're looking at the situation. And even though I use a lot of words to describe it, you know, I tend to always use more words than necessary. But really, you can do that very quick. So to respond just means that moment of, what's this? You just allow a bit more space around the situation, and then do your best to be guided by the quality of sati, by attuning to the situation rather than reacting from your conditioning, your habit. Because if we take a moment, just a half a second, to think, okay, now what's the right thing? What's the best thing here? Then we are able to assess, even very quickly, what the situation is, what will be helpful. And why this is important is because the useful thing, or the right thing, it changes all the time. So one moment it might be the right thing to be very serious or intellectual, and then a second later it's the right thing to crack a joke, you know? But if you'd made the joke before, why? It's be the wrong thing to do. It would cause disharmony. So that quality of satipanya, of attunement, like I use the word samma, I use that as a way of representing the quality of attunement, attuning yourself to the time, the place, the situation. Then, when we do that, we can take action in a very effective way, because we see, okay, that's where the keyhole is, this is the key, put the key in the keyhole and you can open the door. Yeah. Rather than there's a door, just kick at it and see if you can get through, so that you are you're able to act in the world in a much more effective way. It's also not so exhausting. When you're always fighting against the world, then life is very stressful and burdensome. A few years ago, I was giving a Dhamma talk in New York City, and a woman who was one of the people who organized the Buddhist group there, she was a Wall Street lawyer, like a business corporate lawyer for a high finance company. And so she'd been meditating for about 5 years. And she said, before I started to Buddhist meditation, my life was just like one fight after another. It was just so stressful and so difficult and so burdensome. it was just incredibly hard work, and I would just grind my teeth at night, and was restless and agitated and confused. Now I started to meditate. Yeah, it's amazing. People smile at me. It's like almost there's this kind of beautiful way that the world seems to respond. Now I started to meditate, and the way she was talking was like, all the devatas are turning all the lights green as I drive down the street. They're clearing out the parking spaces for me, and because I started to meditate, now I'm a good person. That all of the pratdevata are looking after me. That was the kind of implication that she was giving. Oh, this amazing, wonderful, and marvelous things were happening because she was meditating. And I listened to her and I said, it's probably not that miraculous. But it's more like, just like I used the example about the door, when you come up to a wall, rather than just kicking your way through the door or not even noticing the door, but just smashing away at the wall till you beat your way through, because of meditating, then you're a bit more mindful and you say, oh, before I attack the wall and just drive through it with my head, oh, look, there's a door over there. So you go over to the door. Oh, look, I can turn the handle. I can walk through. Oh, bang, bang. So you feel like, oh, this is so easy. You just walk up to this rectangular shape and you turn the little round thing and you walk through. Wow, it's a miracle. No. It just means you learn to use the door rather than beating your way through life with your head. So that a little bit of mindfulness and wisdom can diminish a lot of the stress and difficulty in our life. And it's not magical. In a way, it's the best kind of magic. It's the magic of learning how to live in tune with life and not to seek for satisfaction in that which cannot satisfy, or to try and do things that cannot be done. But we see what we can do, and then we give our heart to it and do it in the best way possible. And then what we do well, we are able to rejoice, be happy about that. What we can't do, then we just let go and not feel any the less because we weren't able to help everyone.
Thank you.
Yes. Time for one more if I don't talk too long.
My English is not so good, but I will try. I'm curious about language problem. No, I mean, if foreigner, they learn. If foreigner learn Dhamma in English, learn in deep, like Samatha and Vipassana, are there any problem in communication?
I couldn't understand that.
When. จะถามว่าในการเรียนธรรมะของชาวต่างชาติค่ะเวลาที่เรียนในระดับลึกแล้วเนี่ยอย่างเช่นเรียนเรื่องสมถะวิปัสสนาเนี่ยเขามีปัญหาในการเรียนบ้างหรือเปล่าเรื่องการสื่อสารกันคำศัพท์ที่ใช้อ่ะค่ะคือสงสัยว่าในภาษาอังกฤษเนี่ยเขามีคำที่ใช้เป็นมาตรฐานหรือเปล่าหรือว่าคำที่ใช้เป็นที่นิยมไปแล้วหรือเปล่ามีปัญหาแบบว่าวัดแตกต่างกันใช้คำศัพท์ในการอธิบายที่แตกต่างกันอย่างเช่นความหมายเดียวกันแต่ว่าสองวัดใช้คำแตกต่างกันมีปัญหาทำนองนี้ไหมคะ
ใช้คำที่แตกต่างก
ันก็แปลก็แปล
โอเค translate Thai to Thai she said she would like to knowWhen she learns samatha vipassana And if she went to different monastery, and they call different, some call samatha and some call vipassana.
She's wondering that in terms of communication between the Thai and foreign, she wonder and also want to ask about the vocabularies make any difference for understanding in the higher level of meditation like shamatha and vipassana.
Whether the language makes any difference.
Pardon me.
She's asking whether the language makes any difference.
Yes. ภาษาใช่ไหมคะอีกทีได้ค่ะ
อยากรู้ว่าในวัดที่แตกต่างกันเนี่ยของที่ต่างประเทศเนี่ยเขาใช้คำอธิบายแตกต่างกันด้วยหรือเปล่า
She said like in different monastery in foreign countries do you use any different terms of in terms of you know for the understanding
Mostly just the same as the kind of terms that you would be familiar with, so samatha, vipassana. So usually for beginning people, we would translate into English. So samatha, we would say concentration or tranquility. And vipassana, we would say insight, meditation, or development of wisdom. But basically the same concepts.
แล้วก็คำศัพท์ก็จะใช้อย่างที่อาจารย์บอกคือสมถะ what's the use for what you use for the samatha
tranquility
tranquility ค่ะ and vipassana
insight
ค่ะ
แล้วในการอธิบายในระดับการสอนนะคะ
and you also explained in the under the teaching and how to explain and how you explain
อยากรู้ว่าแล้วในขั้นการอธิบายค่ะมาถึงเวลาปฏิบัติจริงๆมันจะมีรายละเอียดปลีกย่อยลงไปอีกนะคะ
She's wondering that during the teaching, how can you explain when it comes for the deeper step and the details on the details? Can you explain it?
Yeah, it can always be explained, but the way you explain it depends on who you're talking to. So like this morning I was at the Siam Samtrai school. So one of the children asked... Can you explain Bloy Wan, how to let go? Little boy, 9 years old, 10 years old. Can you explain Bloy Wan? So I did my best to explain to a 9 year old. But the next one said, was a little girl who asked, what do you do if you don't believe what your parents and your teachers tell you? And then the last one said, is it possible to become a Buddha? So there's some pretty amazing kids here in Bangkok. So. But even so, they're very profound and good questions. You try to explain according to the understanding and the experience of the person who's listening. But I think that the clock has now gone on to 8:30, so it's time to wind up. So thank you all very much for being an attentive audience, and may you take these teachings and may they bring blessings into your life and lead towards the complete ending of suffering.